Sinister grey mists rolled through the docks of Morpork, dripping from the rigging, coiling around the drunken rooftops, lurking in alleys. The docks at night were thought by some to be even more dangerous than the shades. Two muggers, a sneak thief, and someone who'd merely tapped Kanina on the shoulder to ask her the time, had already found this out. "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" said Rincewind, stepping over the luckless pedestrian who lay coiled around his private pain. "Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to cause offence."
"Well?"
"It's just I can't help noticing, You have this certain way with strangers." Rincewind ducked, but nothing happened.
"What are you doing down there?" said Kanina testily.
"Sorry,
I know what you're thinking. I can't help it. I take after my father."
"Who was he then, Cohen the Barbarian?" Rincewind grinned to show it was a joke. At least his lips moved in a desperate crescent.
"No need to laugh about it, wizard."
"What?
It's not my fault."
Rincewind's lips moved soundlessly.
"Sorry," he said. "Have I got this right? Your father really is Cohen the Barbarian?"
"Yes," the girl scowled at Rincewind. "Everyone has to have a father," she added. "Even you, I imagine." She peered around a corner.
"All clear, come on," she said.
And then, when they were striding along the damp cobbles, she continued.
"I expect your father was a wizard, probably."
"I shouldn't think so," said Rincewind. "Wizardry isn't allowed to run in families." He paused. "He knew Cohen. He'd even been a guest at one of his weddings when he'd married a girl of Kanina's age. You could say this about Cohen. He crammed every hour full of minutes. A lot of people would like to take after Cohen. I mean, he was the best fighter, the greatest thief.
A lot of men would," Kanina snapped. She leaned against a wall and glared at him.
"Listen," she said. "There's this long word, see? An old witch told me about it. Can't remember it. You wizards know about long words." Rincewind thought about long words.
"Marmalade?" he volunteered.
She shook her head irritably.
"It means you take after your parents."
Rincewind frowned. He wasn't too good on the subject of parents.
"Kleptomania? Recidivist?" he hazarded.
"Begins with an H."
"Hedonism?" said Rincewind desperately.
"Hereditary," said Kanina. "This witch explained it to me. My mother was a temple dancer for some mad god or other, and father rescued her, and they stayed together for a while. They say I get my looks and figure from her."
"And very good they are, too," said Rincewind, with hopeless gallantry. She blushed.
"Yes. Well, but from him I got sinews you could moor a boat with, reflexes like a snake on a hot tin, and a terrible urge to steal things, and this dreadful sensation every time I meet someone that I should be throwing a knife through his eyes at 90 feet. I can, too," she added with a trace of pride.
"Gosh,
it tends to put men off."
"Well, it would," said Rincewind weakly.
"I mean, when they find out, it's very hard to hang on to a boyfriend."
"Except by the throat, I imagine," said Rincewind. "Not what you really need to build up a proper relationship."
"No, I can see," said Rincewind. "Still, pretty good if you want to be a famous barbarian thief."
"But not," said Kanina, "if you want to be a hairdresser."
"Ah."
They stared into the mist.
"Really a hairdresser?" said Rincewind.
Kanina sighed.
"Not much call for a barbarian hairdresser, I expect," said Rincewind. "I mean, no one wants a shampoo and beheading."
"It's just that every time I see a manicure set, I get this terrible urge to lay about me with a double-handed cuticle knife. I mean, sword," said Kanina. Rincewind sighed.
"I know how it is," he said. "I wanted to be a wizard."
"But you are a wizard."
"Ah, well, of course, but..."
"Quiet!" Rincewind found himself rammed against the wall, where a trickle of condensed mist inexplicably began to drip down his neck. A broad throwing knife had mysteriously appeared in Kanina's hand, and she was crouched like a jungle animal, or even worse, a jungle human.
"What?"
Rincewind began.
"Shut up,"
she hissed.
"Something's coming."
She stood up in one fluid movement, spun on one leg, and let the knife go. There was a single hollow wooden thud. Kanina stood and stared. For once, the heroic blood that pounded through her veins, drowning out all chances of a lifetime in a pink penny, was totally at a loss.
"I've just killed a wooden box," she said.
Rincewind looked round the corner. The luggage stood in the dripping street, the knife still quivering in its lid, and stared at her. Then it changed its position slightly, its little legs moving in a complicated tango pattern, and stared at Rincewind. The luggage didn't have any features at all, apart from a lock and a couple of hinges, but it could stare better than a rock full of iguanas. It could outstare a glass-eyed statue. When it came to a look of betrayed pathos, the luggage could even leave the average kicked spaniel moping back in its kennel. It had several arrowheads and broken swords sticking into it.
"What is it?" hissed Canina.
"It's just the luggage," said Rincewind wearily.
"Does it belong to you?"
"Not really. Sort of."
"Is it dangerous?"
The luggage shuffled round to stare at her again.
"There's two schools of thought about that," said Rincewind. "There's some people who say it's dangerous, and others who say it's very dangerous. What do you think?"
The luggage raised its lid a fraction. The luggage was made from the wood of the sapient pear tree, a plant so magical that it had nearly died out on the disc and survived in only one or two places. It was a sort of rose bay willow herb, only instead of bomb sites, it sprouted in areas that had seen vast expenditures of magic. Wizards' staves were traditionally made of it. So was the luggage. Among the luggage's magical qualities was a fairly simple and direct one. It would follow its adopted owner anywhere. Not anywhere in any particular set of dimensions, or country, or universe, or lifetime. Anywhere. It was about as easy to shake off as a head cold, and considerably more unpleasant. The luggage was also extremely protective of its owner. It would be hard to describe its attitude to the rest of creation, but one could start with the phrase bloody-minded malevolence and work up from there. Canina stared at that lid. It looked very much like a mouth.
"I think I'd vote for terminally dangerous," she said.
"It likes crisps," volunteered Rincewind, and then added, "Well, that's a bit strong. It eats crisps."
"What about people?"
"Oh, yeah, and people. About 15 so far, I think."
"Were they good or bad?"
"Just dead, I think. It also does your laundry for you. You put your clothes in and they come out washed and ironed."
"And covered in blood?"
"You know, that's the funny thing," said Rincewind.
"The funny thing?" repeated Canina, her eyes not leaving the luggage.
"Yes, because, you see, the inside isn't always the same. It's sort of multidimensional, and..."
"How does it feel about women?"
"Oh, it's not choosy. It ate a book of spells last year, sulked for 3 days, and then spat it out."
"It's horrible," said Canina, and backed away.
"Oh, yes," said Rincewind, "absolutely. I mean, the way it stares. It's very good at it, isn't it?"
"We must leave for Klatch," said a voice from the hatbox. "One of those boats will be adequate. Commandeer it."
Rincewind looked at the dim, mist-wreathed shapes that loomed in the mist under a forest of rigging. Here and there a riding light made a little fuzzy ball of light in the gloom.
"Hard to disobey, isn't it?" said Canina.
"I'm trying," said Rincewind. Sweat prickled on his forehead.
"Go aboard now," said the hat.
Rincewind's feet began to shuffle of their own accord.
"Why are you doing this to me?" he moaned.
"Because I have no alternative, believe me. If I could have found an 8th-level mage, I would have done so. I must not be worn."
"Why not? You are the Arch-Chancellor's hat."
"And through me speak all the Arch-Chancellors who ever lived. I am the University. I am the Law. I am the symbol of magic under the control of men, and I will not be worn by a sorcerer. There must be no more sorcerers. The world is too worn out for sorcery."
Canina coughed.
"Did you understand any of that?" she said cautiously.
"I understood some of it, but I didn't believe it," said Rincewind. His feet remained firmly rooted to the cobbles.
"They called me a figure hat."
The voice was heavy with sarcasm.
"Fat wizards who betray everything the University ever stood for. And they called me a figure hat. Rincewind, I command you, and you, madam, serve me well and I will grant you your deepest desire."
"How can you grant my deepest desire if the world's going to end?"
The hat appeared to think about it.
"Well, have you got a deepest desire that need only take a couple of minutes?"
"Look, how can you do magic? You're just a Rincewind's voice trailed off.
"I am magic. Proper magic. Besides, you don't get worn by some of the world's greatest wizards for 2,000 years without learning a few things. Now, we must flee. But with dignity, of course."
Rincewind looked pathetically at Kanina, who shrugged again.
"Don't ask me," she said. "This looks like an adventure. I'm doomed to have them, I'm afraid. That's genetics for you."
The study of genetics on the disc had failed at an early stage when wizards tried the experimental crossing of such well-known subjects as fruit flies and sweet peas. Unfortunately, they didn't quite grasp the fundamentals, and the resultant offspring, a sort of green bean thing that buzzed, led a short, sad life before being eaten by a passing spider.
"But I'm no good at them. Believe me, I've been through dozens," Rincewind wailed.
"Ah, experience," said the Hat.
"No, really, I'm a terrible coward. I always run away."
Rincewind's chest heaved. "Danger has stared me in the back of the head, oh, hundreds of times."
"I don't want you to go into danger."
"Good."
"I want you to stay out of danger."
Rincewind sagged.
"Why me?" he moaned.
"For the good of the university, for the honour of wizardry, for the sake of the world, for your heart's desire. And I'll freeze you alive if you don't."
Rincewind breathed a sigh almost of relief. He wasn't good on bribes or cajolery or appeals to his better nature, but threats, now threats were familiar. He knew where he was with threats. The sun dawned on Small God's Day like a badly poached egg. The mists had closed in over Ankh Morpork in streamers of silver and gold, damp, warm, silent. There was the distant grumbling of springtime thunder out on the plains. It seemed warmer than it ought to be. Wizards normally slept late. On this morning, however, many of them had got up early and were wandering the corridors aimlessly. They could feel the change in the air. The university was filling up with magic. Of course, it was usually full of magic anyway, but it was an old, comfortable magic, as exciting and dangerous as a bedroom slipper. But seeping through the ancient fabric was a new magic, saw-edged and vibrant, bright and cold as comet fire. It sleeted through the stones and crackled off sharp edges like static electricity on the nylon carpet of creation. It buzzed and sizzled. It curled wizardly beards, poured in wisps of octarine smoke from fingers that had done nothing more mystical for three decades than a little light illusion. How can the effect be described with delicacy and taste? For most of the wizards, it was like being an elderly man who, suddenly faced with a beautiful young woman, finds to his horror and delight and astonishment that the flesh is suddenly as willing as the spirit. And in the halls and corridors of the university, the word was being whispered, "Sorcery." A few wizards surreptitiously tried spells that they hadn't been able to master for years, and watched in amazement as they unrolled perfectly. Sheepishly at first, and then with confidence, and then with shouts and whoops, they threw fireballs to one another, or produced live doves out of their hats, or made multicoloured sequins fall out of the air. Sorcery. One or two wizards, stately men who had hitherto done nothing more blameworthy than eat a live oyster, turned themselves invisible and chased the maids and bedders through the corridors. Sorcery. Some of the bolder spirits had tried out ancient flying spells and were bobbing a little uncertainly among the rafters. Sorcery. Only the librarian didn't share in the manic breakfast. He watched the antics for some time, pursing his prehensile lips, and then knuckled stiffly off towards his library. If anyone had bothered to notice, they'd have heard him bolting the door. It was deathly quiet in the library. The books were no longer frantic. They'd passed through their fear and out into the calm waters of abject terror, and they crouched on their shelves like so many mesmerized rabbits. A long hairy arm reached up and grabbed Casplock's Complete Lexicon of Magic with Precepts for the Wise before it could back away, soothed its terror with a long-fingered hand, and opened it under S. The librarian smoothed the trembling page gently and ran a horny nail down the entries until he came to Sorcerer, N, Mythical. A proto-wizard, a doorway through which new magic may enter the world, a wizard not limited by the physical capabilities of his own body, not by destiny, nor by death. It is written that there once were sorcerers in the youth of the world, but not may there be by now, and blessed be, for sorcery is not for men, and the return of sorcery would mean the end of the world. If the Creator had meant men to be as goddesses, he would have given them wings. See also The Apocalypse,
The Legend of the Ice Giants, and The Tea Time of the Goddess. The librarian read the cross-references, turned back to the first entry, and stared at it through deep dark eyes for a long time. Then he put the book back carefully, crept under his desk, and pulled the blanket over his head. But in the minstrel gallery over the great hall, Carding and Spelter watched the scene with entirely different emotions. Standing side by side, they looked almost exactly like the number 10.
"What is happening?" said Spelter. He'd had a sleepless night and wasn't thinking very straight.
"Magic is flowing into the university," said Carding. "That's what sorcerer means. A channel for magic. Real magic, my boy. Not the tired old stuff we've made do with these past centuries. This is a dawning of a...
new dawn?"
"Exactly. A time of miracles. Annus mirabilis?"
Carding frowned.
"Yes," he said eventually. "Something like that, I expect. You have quite a way with words, you know."
"Thank you, brother."
The senior wizard appeared to ignore the familiarity. Instead, he turned and leaned on the carved rail, watching the magical displays below them. His hands automatically went to his pockets for his tobacco pouch, and then paused. He grinned and snapped his fingers. A lighted cigar appeared in his mouth.
"Haven't been able to do that in years," he mused. "Big changes, my boy. They haven't realized it yet, but it's the end of the orders and levels. That was just a rationing system. We don't need them anymore. Where is the boy?"
"Still asleep," Spelter began.
"I am here," said Coyne.
He stood in the archway leading to the senior wizard's quarters, holding the Octoron staff that was half again as tall as he was. Little veins of yellow fire coruscated across its matte black surface, which was so dark that it looked like a slit in the world. Spelter felt the golden eyes bore through him, as if his innermost thoughts were being scrolled across the back of his skull.
"Ah,"
he said, in a voice that he believed was jolly and avuncular, but in fact sounded like a strangled death rattle. After a start like that, his contribution could only get worse, and it did.
"I see you're up," he said.
"My dear boy," said Carding.
Coyne gave him a long, freezing stare.
"I saw you last night," he said. "Are you puissant?"
"Only mildly," said Carding,
hurriedly recalling the boy's tendency to treat wizardry as a terminal game of conkers.
"But not so puissant as you, I'm sure."
"Am I to be made Arch-Chancellor, as is my destiny?"
"Oh, absolutely," said Carding. "No doubt about it. May I have a look at your staff? Such an interesting design."
He reached out a pudgy hand. It was a shocking breach of etiquette in any case. No wizard should even think of touching another's staff without his express permission. But there are people who can't quite believe that children are fully human and think that the operation of normal good manners doesn't apply to them. Carding's fingers curled around the black staff. There was a noise that Spelter felt rather than heard, and Carding bounced across the gallery and struck the opposite wall with a sound like a sack of lard hitting a pavement.
"Don't do that," said Coyne.
He turned and looked through Spelter, who had gone pale, and added,
"Help him up. He's probably not badly hurt."
The bursar scuttled hurriedly across the floor and bent over Carding, who was breathing heavily and had gone an odd colour. He patted the wizard's hand until Carding opened one eye.
"Did you see what happened?" he whispered.
"I'm not sure. What did happen?"
hissed Spelter.
"It bit me."
"The next time you touch the staff," said Coyne, matter-of-factly, "you will die. Do you understand?"
Carding raised his head gently, in case bits of it fell off.
"Absolutely," he said.
"And now I would like to see the university," the boy continued. "I have heard a great deal about it."
Spelter helped Carding to his unsteady feet and supported him as they trotted obediently after the boy.
"Don't touch his staff," muttered Carding.
"I'll, remember not to," said Spelter firmly. "What did it feel like?"
"Have you ever been bitten by a viper?"
"No. In that case, you'll understand exactly what it felt like."
"Hmm?"
"It wasn't like a snake bite at all." They hurried after the determined figure as Coyne marched down the stairs and through the ravished doorway of the great hall. Spelter dodged in front, anxious to make a good impression. "This is the Great Hall," he said. Coin turned his golden gaze towards him, and the wizard felt his mouth dry up. "It's called that because it's a hall, you see, and big." He swallowed. "It's a big hall," he said, fighting to stop the last of his coherence being burned away by the searchlight of that stair. "A great big hall, which is why it's called—" "Who are those people?" said Coin. He pointed with his staff. The assembled wizards who had turned to watch him enter backed out of the way as though the staff was a flamethrower. Spelter followed the sorcerer's stare. Coin was pointing to the portraits and statues of former arch-chancellors, which decorated the walls. Full-bearded and point-hatted, clutching ornamental scrolls or holding mysterious symbolic bits of astrological equipment, they stared down with ferocious self-importance, or possibly chronic constipation. "From these walls," said Carding, 200 supreme mages look down upon you."
"I don't care for them," said Coin, and the staff streamed octarine fire.
The arch-chancellors vanished.
"And the windows are too small. The ceiling is too high. Everything is too old."
The wizards threw themselves flat as the staff flared and spat. Spelter pulled his hat over his eyes and rolled under a table when the very fabric of the university flowed around him. Wood creaked. Stone groaned. Something tapped him on the head. He screamed.
"Stop that," shouted Carding above the din, "and pull your hat up. Show a little dignity."
"Why are you under the table, then?" said Spelter sourly.
"We must seize our opportunity."
"What, like the staff?"
"Follow me."
Spelter emerged into a bright, a horrible bright new world. Gone were the rough stone walls, gone were the dark owl-haunted rafters, gone were the tiled floor with its eye-boggling pattern of black and white tiles. Gone, too, were the high small windows with their gentle patina of antique grease. Raw sunlight streamed into the hall for the first time. The wizards stared at one another, mouths open, and what they saw was not what they'd always thought they'd seen. The unforgiving rays transmuted rich gold embroidery into dusty gilt, exposed opulent fabric as rather stained and threadbare velvet, turned fine-flowing beards into nicotine-stained tangles, betrayed splendid diamonds as rather inferior ankh-stones. The fresh light probed and prodded, stripping away the comfortable shadows. And, Spelter had to admit, what was left didn't inspire confidence. He was suddenly acutely aware that under his robes, his tattered, badly faded robes, he realized with an added spasm of guilt, the robes with the perforated area where the mice had got at them, he was still wearing his bedroom slippers. The hall was now almost all glass. What wasn't glass was marble. It was all so splendid that Spelter felt quite unworthy. He turned to Carding and saw that his fellow wizard was staring at Coin with his eyes gleaming. Most of the other wizards had the same expression. If wizards weren't attracted to power, they wouldn't be wizards, and this was real power. The staff had them charmed like so many cobras. Carding reached out to touch the boy on the shoulder, and then thought the better of it.
"Magnificent,"
he said instead. He turned to the assembled wizardry and raised his arms.
"My brothers," he intoned, "we have in our midst a wizard of great power."
Spelter tugged at his robe.
"He nearly killed you,"
he hissed.
Carding ignored him. "And I propose,"
Carding swallowed,
"I propose him for Arch-Chancellor."
There was a moment's silence, and then a burst of cheering and shouts of dissent. Several quarrels broke out at the back of the crowd. The wizards nearer the front weren't quite so ready to argue. They could see the smile on Coin's face. It was bright and cold, like the smile on the face of the moon. There was a commotion, and an elderly wizard fought his way to the front of the throng. Spelter recognized Ovin Harkardly, the seventh-level wizard and a lecturer in law. He was red with anger, except where he was white with rage. When he spoke, his words seared through the air like so many knives, clipped as topiary, crisp as biscuits.
"Are you mad?"
he said.
"No one but a wizard of the eighth level may become Arch-Chancellor, and he must be elected by the other most senior wizards in solemn convocation. Duly guided by the gods, of course. It is the law. The very idea."
Harkardly had studied the law of magic for years, and because magic always tends to be a two-way process, it had made its mark on him. He gave the impression of being as fragile as a cheese straw, and in some unaccountable way the dryness of his endeavours had left him with the ability to pronounce punctuation.
He stood vibrating with indignation, and he became aware he was rapidly standing alone. In fact, he was at the centre of an expanding circle of empty floor, fringed with wizards who were suddenly ready to swear that they'd never clapped eyes on him in their life. Coin raised his staff. Harkardly raised an admonitory finger.
"You do not frighten me, young man," he snapped. "Talented you may be, but magical talent alone is not enough. There are many other qualities required of a great wizard. Administrative ability, for example, and wisdom, and the—"
Coin lowered his staff.
"The law applies to all wizards, does it not?" he said.
"Absolutely! It was drawn up!"
"But I am not a wizard, Lord Harkardly."
The wizard hesitated.
"Ah,"
he said, and hesitated again.
"Good point," he said. "But I am well aware of the need for wisdom, foresight, and good advice, and I would be honoured if you could see your way clear to providing those much-valued commodities. For example, why is it that wizards do not rule the world?"
"What?"
"It is a simple question. There are in this room,"
Coin's lips moved for a fraction of a second,
472 wizards, skilled in the most subtle of arts. Yet all you rule are these few acres of rather inferior architecture. Why is this?"
The most senior wizards exchanged knowing glances.
"Such it may appear," said Harkardly eventually. "But, my child, we have domains beyond the ken of temporal power."
His eyes gleamed.
"Magic can surely take the mind to inner landscapes of arcane—"
"Yes, yes," said Coin. "Yet there are extremely solid walls outside your university. Why is this?"
Carding ran his tongue over his lips. It was extraordinary. The child was speaking his thoughts.
"You squabble for power," said Coin sweetly, "and yet beyond these walls, to the man who carts night soil or the average merchant, is there really so much difference between a high-level mage and a mere conjurer?"
Harkardly stared at him in complete and untrammelled astonishment.
"Child, it's obvious to the meanest citizen," he said, "the robes and trimmings themselves."
"Ah," said Coin, "the robes and trimmings, of course."
A short, heavy and thoughtful silence filled the hall.
"It seems to me," said Coin eventually, "that wizards rule only wizards. Who rules in the reality outside?"
"As far as the city is concerned, that would be the patrician, Lord Vetinari," said Carding, with some caution.
"And is he a fair and just ruler?"
Carding thought about it. The patrician's spy network was said to be superb.
"I would say," he said carefully, "that he is unfair and unjust, but scrupulously even-handed. He is unfair and unjust to everyone, without fear or favour."
"And you are content with this?" said Coin.
Carding tried not to catch Harkardly's eye.
"It's not a case of being content with it," he said. "I suppose we've not given it much thought. A wizard's true vocation, you see—"
"Is it really true that the wise suffer themselves to be ruled in this way?"
Carding growled.
"Of course not. Don't be silly. We merely tolerate it. That's what wisdom is all about. You'll find that out when you grow up. It's a case of biding one's time."
"Where is this patrician? I would like to see him."
"That can be arranged, of course," said Carding.
"The patrician is always graciously pleased to grant wizards an interview, and—"
"Now I will grant him an interview," said Coin. "He must learn that wizards have bided their time long enough. Stand back, please."
He pointed the staff.